Today on Maine Calling, humorous tales from the campaign trail and life in Maine. Anything can happen when you're out knocking on doors in search of votes. Animals on the attack, people with unusual stories they want to share, and unexpected events. And while politics can be serious business, it can also be quite funny. A new book, Real Life, Real Funny, The Way Maine Humor Should Be, captures the stories of some well-known political figures, the advisors who guided them, and the journalists who covered them. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll share some of those stories with the three editors of the collection, former Maine Congressman Dave Emery, pollster and Bowdoin College Professor Emeritus Chris Potholm, and former campaign advisor and staffer Dennis Bailey. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions, and Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum School recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. If you're looking for a little humor to take the edge off of news about national and global conflicts, you're in luck. Today we have the three editors of the just-released book, Real Life, Real Funny. It's a collection of essays from a time back when politics was fun. That's a reference from the book. Joining me today, Chris Potholm, former professor of government at Bowdoin College. He's also a former registered Maine guide and the author of six books on Maine subjects. Dennis Bailey, a former journalist who served as Governor Angus King's communication director before opening his own PR company, Savvy Inc. And Dave Emery is with us. He spent his career working in the Maine political scene, serving in the state legislature and in the U.S. Congress. We invite you to join the conversation, as always. How would you describe Maine humor? Do you have a funny story to tell? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. That's 1-800-399-3566, the number 1-800-399-3566. This book, welcome, gentlemen, first of all. This book hints of a conversation of a few people that might have been sitting around a while back swapping stories of politics and other things, and then somebody piped up and said, hey, we should write this down. What was the origin of the book? And I'll let whoever wants to take the lead.
Well, I think I was the one who began the idea because I had known these two bozos for a long time, and they always had me in stitches with their stories. And I said, look, this is really fun. Let's put these things down. And then we included other people, and they had other people. And we sort of said, let's keep it light. Let's keep it authentic. Let's have these real stories. And I've done a lot of books, obviously, but I've never had more fun than I had with this one. And these two guys are just, they had me in stitches. And I mean, some of the stories we couldn't put into the book, but they were funny, too.
I want to talk about what didn't make the book and why in a little bit. Chris Potholm.
Well, I don't know if we want to get into that, but
before we jump into what your publisher described as the bouillabaisse of stories, I want to talk a little bit about the opening chapter, which is briefly titled Back When Politics Was Fun, suggesting two things. One, that politics is fun, and secondly, that maybe it no longer is. Dave Emery, I'll get your take. Was there a time when politics was fun, and is it no longer fun?
Well, I think it can be fun, but let's face it, with social media and everyone in their own silos, you don't have the same byplay and open conversation that we used to have. And people seem to be so surly now in their attitudes toward people with whom they may disagree. And it's very frustrating because, you know, I remember when I was in Congress, there were a lot of people I didn't agree with on politics, but we'd go out and have a beer, or we'd sit around and talk about baseball or whatever the subject might be. And I just wish the time would come when we could get back to that. Not only as a society generally, but particularly in the political arena, because those of us who have been in that business for any length of time and have had to deal with issues and subjects and problems know that the only way you solve them is when people of goodwill with different points of view can get together and try to find common ground. And that's what's been missing. This business of silos rather than common place to visit and talk, I think is part of the problem.
Yeah. Dennis, you've helped to strategize in campaigns and worked on staffs. What's changed then? Is it the personalities involved, or is it, you know, social media and the way that campaigns are run that it's become so personal?
It's become so polemic. I mean, everybody has a side now. I mean, I have friends and relatives that you can't talk to them anymore because in my case, they're Trump supporters, you know, so it's hard to even have that conversation. I don't remember it being like that in the past. I never thought that your political position, your views on things, it got in the way of basic friendship and basic, you know, getting along. It does now, and I don't really know why. It just has become much more there's a lot of anger out there, and I don't even know what the anger stems from, really. People seem to be angry about something, but and they vent, you know, and it is social media. I mean, there are many times where I'll say something on social media, seem benign statement, and gee, I'll just get all these attacks from people. Just I don't get it. I mean, I talk about it in the book because I have this feeling that Angus used to keep me around just because I was kind of a jokester, that, you know, I'd go into these heavy meetings about closing Maine Yankee or a clear-cut referendum kind of fall asleep, and he'd turn to me and say, well, what do you think, Dennis? And invariably I just say something funny, and he liked that. I think it just brought everything back to earth. It brought everybody down. And, you know, it took the gas out of people. And so there's value in that. There's value in humor. And it's easy to forget this day and age that you can have fun at these things. You don't have to be tearing each other apart.
Yeah, we should point out that this panel sitting here today comes from different political backgrounds. Dave Emery, you were a lifelong Republican. Chris Pothome, you've worked with and for Republicans. And Dennis, you... I would characterize you as not a Republican, but you obviously embody this kind of spirit.
How about characterizing me as a hired gun? I work with Republicans, Democrats, Independents. Yeah. I always thought I was the independent variable, but the book tells a different story. How we think we're trying to do something, and the reverse happens. So. I think to just add to the, I think the biggest difference between now and then is back then, even if you disagreed with somebody, you didn't treat them like they were a mortal enemy, A. Yeah. And B, there was a set of facts. Today, since Trump appeared on the scene, I've had thousands of conversations. I've never been able to convert one Trump person to another. Nor have I been able to convince them that the moon is not made of green cheese, no matter how many times he says it.
Yeah, this could be a long... we could spend the hour on alternative facts or any other number of subjects that have only emerged recently. But let's get back to the book. There's something about politicians that make them sort of the good butts of jokes, in the same way that, you know, tourists and salesmen, they're all sort of slickers who have come to a local place and trying to sell the locals on something. And because they're out of their element, there's this tension. And in that tension is the source of the hilarity in a lot of these traditional stories. But we actually did you find this in real life in some of these stories? People on the campaign trail trying to put on their best face, and when something goes wrong, that's kind of what's funny.
Well, you know, I think the basic fact is that if you go into a campaign and try to act like someone you're not, you try to impress someone with expertise you don't have, then it's going to collapse. But I guess the theory of the book, from my perspective, is that most politicians are not much different than anyone else. They make mistakes. They use bad language. They, you know, they like to have a beer with their friends. You know, they can get into situations that can be embarrassing or hilarious, depending on which side of the fence you're on. And, you know, I look at some of the stories in the book, and particularly some of the experiences that I've had. There's definitely a disconnect between what people expect of a politician or an elected official and what the reality is. Just a couple of examples. I remember one time, I guess it was probably when I was first running for Congress, I walked around the district and would shake hands with whoever I ran into, and there were a couple of carpenters working on a house. So I went over and introduced myself. The guy didn't say a word to me. He handed me a nail and a hammer. And I think he expected I was going to try to eat them or throw them or whatever, but I drove the nail in where it was supposed to be. And he looked at me as if he had just seen a Martian. He couldn't believe that someone running for office would know a simple skill like that. So, I mean, that's kind of the disconnect that you get. You know, you hear stories all the time. Politicians are dishonest. Politicians are greedy. Politicians don't care about the average person. Most of the people I served with may have had different views than I had, but at the end of the day, they wanted to do a good job. They wanted to be helpful to their constituents, and they didn't expect anything from their service other than, you know, their pay, obviously, but the gratitude of people who they helped. Not much different than your next door neighbor or your doctor or the grocer down the street or the guy who carries out the trash. I mean, most people are honest and sincere and decent, and, you know, with a few notable exceptions that we can't ignore. I think most people that I've experienced in the political arena are pretty much that same way.
I actually think that's one of my favorite parts of the book, these stories from candidates and campaigns like Dave and Bill Cohen and Bill Diamond, and, you know, the reality of campaigning. I don't think people really know enough. They see TV ads and they see news shows, but they don't know the hard door-to-door, you know, going around meeting main characters and getting into situations that are just funny by themselves. And that's what the book brings out. It's the reality of campaigning.
Let's get a little sample directly from the book that I think illustrates what you're talking about there, Dennis. This is Chris Potholm's piece titled Henry Kissinger Channels Jesus of Nazareth. That's the one you wanted to read from, Chris, right?
Yeah,
I will read from. I'll read the beginning, and then you can sort of fill in the story at the end. As Bill Cohen's political guy in Maine, I often went to a variety of places to meet with people and groups, sometimes ones not his favorite, or if he was already booked in order to show the flag. Sometimes, though, he asked me to go to other events where he was participating just so I could share his joy or the pain, as the case might be. One such event occurred when the Maine Republican State Committee invited Henry Kissinger, former National Security Advisor and subsequent Secretary of State under Richard Nixon, to come to Maine in early November 1979 and hawk his new book, and also to get some newly invented for his benefit Rockefeller Award from the Republican Party. Imagine the chances of naming it that today. Just continue on the gist of the story and tell us what happened, if you would.
Well, I was asked to ride in the car that picked him up at the airport, and it was an odd collection of people. It was the head of the Republican Party, Hattie Bickmore, and then there was Bob Monks, who was really the father of modern Republicanism in Maine, and the driver. And I guess I was supposed to talk about ICBMs and whatnot, but when Kissinger got into the car, the first thing Bob Monks did was light up a gigantic cigar and began blowing the smoke directly in Kissinger's face. And Kissinger looked wildly around, but his bodyguards were in the second car and they were of absolutely no help. And he began coughing and pointing to the window, and Bob Monks did roll the window down, which simply brought the smoke directly into Henry's face, but at a higher level. And Hattie Bickmore began kicking the bottom of my seat, which I took as a sign that she wanted me to engage him in some intellectual thing. So we started talking about ICBMs and to throw weight. And I asked him a variety of questions, which seemed to calm him a little bit. But it was really the oddest anti-war demonstration that I had ever participated in. And when we got to the place, and I don't know how Dave or Dennis feel, but I always hated going to those political things where you could smell the sterno. To this day, a sterno cooked chicken makes me feel sick to my stomach. Anyway, there was a thing, and Dave Emery was sitting up on this hot raised platform along with Bill Cohen and Olympia Snow and the important people. And I was back with the staff peons. And so I usually would go to these things and spend a few minutes. And then when the senator was all taken care of, I would sneak out the back door and go home. Well, I got to the end of the hall, and all the other staffers were pointing, and that Bill Cohen was waving wildly for me to come up there. I said, oh, damn, I almost made it out. But anyway, I went back up, and Kissinger had brought with him about 100 books to be signed. And somehow, while he was up there eating, people began buying the books and bringing them up. And Cohen thought this was a little undignified. There's probably 5 or 6 people in a line. And he said to me, stop that. I looked around like, what was I supposed to do? Well, he just said, stop it. So I went over and said, oh, gosh, people, please, please, you know, the secretary is trying to eat. He's trying to, you know, let him relax. And, you know, the legislator, female legislator from down east, said several bad words to me. And another one said, yes, get out of the way. And so there I am trying to hold back the sea of these people who are all waving books around. And then all of a sudden I hear, let them come, Chris. Let them come. Kissinger standing up and motioning, let them come. So I turned around and looked at Cohen like, what the hell am I supposed to do now? And I couldn't get Cohen's attention. He was looking down on the plate, talking to the person next to him. So, you know, I said, well, okay. And as I walked out, all the other staff members, where they were laughing and joking, and one of them said, well, that went well, Chris. And I got in my car, I went home, and I had a vodka tonic, and I thought the Republic is in pretty good hands, I guess. No thanks to me.
you mentioned Hattie Bickmore, who is a character who emerges in other parts of the book. Dave Emery, there's a story, I believe, first of all, who was she?
Oh, Hattie was a wonderful woman. She was the Republican state chairman. She'd been on the state committee. She worked for me. She was my district office administrator. And she probably knew 87% of the people who lived in Cumberland County. I mean, She was remarkable. She could go into a circle of highbrow officials, and she'd call them sweetheart, and just have a meeting out of her hand. Or she could go into a union hall or a construction site, and someone makes some comment to her about being a Republican, and she, oh, you wouldn't want to put a widow out of work. I mean, she just had a way about her that was endearing, and everyone liked Hattie, whoever met her. She was fabulous, but Hattie was character, and she had ways of getting herself into funny situations on occasion. I really miss her. She's been gone for a little while.
Sorry about the wig. Could you share that with us?
Yeah, unfortunately, I wasn't there to see that. But that's one of the great stories. She'd had a wig for whatever reason. I guess they were in style, and she was out to eat at this restaurant. And as it turned out, the wig didn't fit just right, and it was a little itchy and hot underneath. So as anyone would do, she'd reach up and she'd try to adjust it and try to pull it down so it fit right or whatever. And, it was not spring loaded, but it was kept in place by an elastic band. And as I said in the book, anyone in high school who knows how to snap elastic bands at his buddy knows that if you do it just right, as Isaac Newton pointed out, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So she snapped the wig, it flew in the guy's plate on the next table. So, it was that kind of a funny thing that would happen with Hattie all the time. But you can imagine if you're in a restaurant eating your spaghetti or whatever, and all of a sudden this airborne flying squirrel of a wig landed in the plate, it would probably be a showstopper. But that's what happened.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more stories from the campaign trail and from life in Maine. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're hearing about some humor-filled stories collected in a new book. It's called Real Life, Real Funny. My guests are the editors of the book. Dennis Bailey, a former journalist who served as then-Governor Angus King's communications director for many years before opening his own public relations company. He now lives in as a digital nomad just outside of Lisbon. That's not Lisbon, Maine. That's Lisbon, Portugal. I don't know what time it is there, Dennis, but thank you. Dave Emery has been involved for a long time with Maine's political scene, serving in the legislature and in the Congress, more recently providing polling services and data. And Chris Potholm, former professor of government at Bowdoin College, a former registered Maine guide and author of six books. We're going to go to the phones now. We're joined by Eddie Adelman. He's a former columnist for the Portland Press Herald and the Bangor Daily News, and also a contributor to Maine Public's no longer existing program, Maine Things Considered. Some of you may remember that program. He is the author of a new collection of essays as well, but this is called Don't Get Me Started. Eddie Adelman, thanks for giving us a call, and welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Keith.
Yeah, so it's been like 25 years, I think, since we last heard your dulcet tones on Maine Public. But tell us about, you're obviously from New York. We could just say that at the top. So you have a different take maybe on Maine humor as an observer or as a writer?
Yeah, I do. And I just wanted, if I can, I just wanted to make two points. One of which is about Maine humor in general, and the other one is about politics, which I've written about in the past. And on that first point, it's true, I do write humor, but not necessarily Maine humor. I'm more like a humorist who happens to live in Maine. That being said, I love Maine humor. And at its best, Maine humor doesn't rely on punchlines, but rather on the comedic situations that the characters find themselves in. It can't help but make you laugh. What comes to mind is Tim Sample's book, Saturday Night at Moody's Diner. By the way, I'm not getting paid by him. I'm just bringing it up. In one bit from that book, fishermen from Rockland come into the diner a day after a day of fishing, still gamey, as Sample calls them, and actually set off the smoke alarms. Now, that's genuinely funny, and there's no punchline there. It's just the situation that makes it funny. And the second point I wanted to make is about politics. Back in 2002, back when I was on Main Things Considered, when I had my column with the Press, I also had a column with the Press Herald, there was a hotly contested governor's race. So I wrote a column called Edelman for Governor. And since I wasn't really running, I could promise Mainers the world. Free gasoline, free ice cream, a lobster in every pot, and last but not least, no more of those pesky taxes. Actually, if any of the current candidates are listening, they might want to consider a fresh approach to the scorched earth strategy that they're using right now. And while I'm at it, one last point. Years ago, when Ronald Reagan was running for president, people were thinking, well, he's just too old. And in one of the debates, he said, it's not an exact quote, but he said, I won't hold my opponent's youth and inexperience against him. And it really got a laugh. So you can use humor to your advantage without having to destroy the other candidate.
Yeah, Eddie Edelman. Eddie, thanks so much for joining us. Nice to hear from you again, and good luck and congratulations on the new book, which is Don't Get Me Started. Any thoughts from the group before we move on to back to your book?
Well, I think the first chapter where it talks really almost a history of Maine humor is worth the price of the book. I don't think people realize the breadth. People think of Maine humor, they think of Bert Nye or Tim Sample or my old friend John McDonald or someone. But the breadth of Maine humor going through history is really interesting. You know, Andrea Martin, for example, is an actress who's from, well, she was born in Portland. Her father was a well-known restaurateur, and she's been in movies. Von Meter, the guy who had a best-selling album of John Kennedy parody. It was the biggest selling album in history before the Beatles. You know, those kind of things that we talk about in the book. There's something about Maine humor, like he was saying, it's not a punchline. It's atmospheric. And I don't know if any other state has its own brand of humor. I've never heard Idaho humor or Arizona humor. You know, it's unique that Maine has a particular brand and people love it.
Yeah, I think you made a point, Dennis, that it sort of reminds us of the world discovering that Liverpool had its own kind of local sense of humor when the Beatles came out. The Beatles didn't necessarily think of themselves as funny. They were just being from Liverpool.
And they said it themselves, everybody is funny in Liverpool. And that's kind of the way it is in Maine. My father used to get together with his brothers, my uncles, it would just be laughs. I mean, they would just tell stories. And, you know, the main kind of humor that epitomizes Maine humor for me are the lines like, you know, when someone's asked, have you lived here all your life? And the guy says, well, not yet. Typical Maine humor. That's it's not really funny, but it's ironic and it's, you know, goes to the point. And those kind of stories are the ones that you know, are classified Maine humor.
Go ahead.
You never know when a situation like that is going to pop up. And that's what makes it kind of fun.
Yeah.
I remember when I ran for Congress the first time doing my walk down through southern Maine. I was in, if I remember, it was the town of Waterboro. And just walking down the road, it came upon this beautiful farmhouse. It was a farmhouse and a beautiful barn and well landscaped. And there was a fellow working in his garden. So I went over to say hello to him. Halfway through the conversation, he says, hold that thought, I'll be right back. So he came out of his barn with a shotgun, and I thought to myself, what the heck is going on here? So he says, you look over on the other side of the garden, you see that damn woodchuck, I've been trying to get him for 3 weeks. So he shot, and all I can tell you, I don't know what he had for pellets in his shotgun. I don't know what he used, but that woodchuck couldn't have eaten a tenth of the vegetables that he mowed down with that shotgun. So I said, well, I guess you got him, walked on. But, you know, it's just, it's ironic stuff like that.
Yeah,
you never know when it's going to show up.
Yeah.
Let's read I'll read the opening of one of your stories, Dave Emery. This is called Read the Signs More Carefully Next Time. And I'll read the open and you can explain the rest of the story. An incident of note that did not involve the ubiquitous Hattie Bickmore took place immediately following my 1978 re-election campaign. I'd been scheduled to address a statewide meeting of the VFW Auxiliary held at the Samoset Resort in Rockport 2 days following the election that year. Naturally, I was very exhausted from the campaign and really would have preferred to go somewhere to relax for a few days, but you never turn down an invitation to address veterans, especially during a campaign or right after. You do not want to disappoint the veterans ever. They don't deserve to be disappointed. You always want to go the extra mile to show veterans your appreciation and their service and all they have done for our country. So take the story from there, if you would.
Yeah, it was, as the introduction to the story pointed out, it was an invitation that I'd picked up someplace during the summer or early fall. And you know, obviously any candidate wants to address the VFW. Although in this case, the meeting was 2 or 3 days after the election, but you didn't turn it down. Obviously, you're not going to turn it down. So there I was. And as it turned out, it was long. It was sonorous. It was hot in the room. There was smoke. And you know, usually expect to speak at about 9 o'clock and finish up at 9:30 at the latest. Well, this went on and on and on and on with everyone who ever was at a VFW meeting being introduced. So I don't know, about 10:15 or whatever the time was, I decided, well, no one's paying attention. They're all at the bar or they're, you know, so I spoke for about 4 minutes and left. Well, my staff with me, two friends, my local chairman and then one of my Washington staffers, were there in the back room looking at their watches and so forth. And one of them had disappeared. And we couldn't find him after the speech was over. We looked in the bar. We looked in the, you know, in various rooms and so forth. Now, he wasn't around. He wasn't around anywhere. So we went out to the car thinking he might have snuck out early. So we were there 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And a little later on, he came running out the front door with this wild look in his eyes, jumped in the car, and we said, "What the heck happened to you? Where have you been?" He says, "Well, you stopped speaking before I thought I had time to go to the men's room and so forth. So I was in the men's room and you know, all of a sudden this woman came in." And I thought, "Oh, is she going to be embarrassed when I walk out of the stall?" And then another woman came in, So obviously he was in the wrong restroom. So then he thought to himself, "What happens if one of them look under the door and see men's shoes?" So he pulled himself up and balanced himself on the seat as best he could with one hand on the latch and the other hand on the toilet paper dispenser, hoping not to either fall off or fall in. And finally, when he didn't hear any further noise, he ran out like a scared rabbit. But if you can imagine the situation that he must have been in, sitting in there, being concerned that he was going to be caught as an interloper in the ladies' room. At any rate, rest of the story is if I used a false name in the narrative, because you might know who the person was otherwise, but I'm not going to embarrass him.
So it struck me as I was reading that story that this is clearly in the days before cell phones. Many of these many of these situations could have been fixed with a text. Right. You know, "Help me, I'm stuck." Or
exactly. But well, so, no, we had no idea where he was. We had absolutely no idea. We thought he left with the auxiliary members, maybe, but he didn't.
Right. This also kind of, I was going to follow up what you just mentioned. You changed the name of someone, and I'm wondering if there are story. How often did you change names, first of all, in these stories to avoid either, I don't know, legal issues or just even embarrassment? Did you have to be careful about that?
Well, in that particular instance, that's the only one that I changed, and it was simply because I wasn't able to contact him to find out if he minded if I used his name. So I didn't think it was appropriate.
There are a couple of stories I wish I had changed my name, because
we'll get to one of yours in a second, Dennis. But we all know that, you know, memories have this way of changing, shape-shifting over time. And I'm wondering, did you have to do any fact-checking to verify this happened, or this happened at a certain time, or that these people were present?
I don't remember. I mean, it's part of the joy of Maine storytelling is the embellishments that come with it.
That's true.
You know, when I think of stories, you know, I used to go on hunting trips with my father, and everybody would sit around telling stories, the same ones they told at last year's hunting stories, but they would change, you know, they would get better and funnier. And nobody, you didn't fact check in those days, and you sort of took it with a grain of salt. You knew they were embellishing, but it was funny.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number, as always, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're talking about a new book that shares some funny stories about life in Maine. Joining me, the book's editors, Dave Emery, spent his career working in Maine politics and served in Congress. Dennis Bailey worked in journalism and politics and then public relations. And Chris Potholm, former Bowdoin government professor. Share your comments and questions. Email us talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or just give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Dennis, I want to share a story that you included in the book, and I'll read the beginning and you can finish it out for us. It's called Land of the Disappointing Toys. As a kid, I had an active imagination, maybe overactive. Yes, of course, overactive. Still do, as a matter of fact. I suppose an active imagination is a desirable trait for a kid growing up in a rural, low-income household in Maine. You had to rely on your imagination for enjoyment when more pricey forms of entertainment, a movie, a new bike, a Red Sox game, were way out of reach. But my active imagination also made me easy prey for all the commercials and advertisements aimed at kids' toys. This was the late 50s and early 60s, before strict Federal Trade Commission rules and other regulations clamped down on misleading or fake advertisements. For example, a favorite show at the time was Supercar, a futuristic adventure series with marionettes, and the star was Supercar, a flying craft that could do anything, rocket into space, dive into the ocean, or soar through the clouds. Amazing!
Except that it didn't do any of those things. The advertisement made it look like this great toy that you have, and, you know, impress your friends with all this flying around with it. And then, you know, my parents would dutifully get what I wanted for Christmas, and they got it, and then it just put it on the floor and you wind it up and it goes around, and it was incredibly disappointing. And when I started writing the story, I realized there were many of these instances where I'd used my active imagination. The worst one was probably, I had a comic book that said, that had an ad in it for 3 aluminum solid fuel rockets for $5. And I had a paper route at the time, so I sent away my $5. And I had this dream of, you know, there would be a flatbed truck pulling into the driveway and setting up a big aluminum rocket in the front yard, and it's going to bother the neighbors, and where are we going to put it, and how are we going to launch it? And finally, I got this envelope in the mail one day and opened it up, and it was three matches wrapped in aluminum, like tinfoil. And that was the three rockets, and you lit them with a lighter, and it, you know, they went up 20 feet in the air, and that was it. You know, lesson learned. I'm an idiot, you know, but in those days, those kind of ads were everywhere for those kind of, you know, sea monkeys and, you know, different things that would just suck you in as a kid. We had this thing called the Johnson Smith catalog. I don't know if you remember that, but it had all kinds of these toys that you would just dream over. And then when you'd get them, they were a piece of crap, obvious.
Yeah, I remember X-ray goggles.
X-ray goggles, yeah. Rubber vomit. I mean, you had all kinds of stuff.
The whole thing. let's go to the phones. Let's bring in Scott, who's calling from Lisbon Falls. Hi, Scott. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've been a candidate for the Maine House a bunch of times, so I certainly knocked on doors and talked to people, but the Maine humor was something I always utilized, and being a native, it helps. But I also wanted to say that Maine humor is not unique to Maine. There's a folk song called the Arkansas Traveler that speaks about that same sort of dichotomy between the country bumpkin that doesn't know anything and that city slicker that knows everything. You know, we all know, can I take this road to East Millinocket? He says, geez, I got one there already. You know, that kind of story. So it is a national thing, and it really speaks to where ignorance lies. And the humor of it is that the person that's supposedly on top of this game is the one that is the butt of the joke.
Right. Yes. And politicians are sort of seem ripe for that that role sometimes in these stories. Scott, thank you very much. Let's go to Luke in Portland. Hi, Luke. Welcome.
Hi, Keith. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for the panelists and for you, along with a quick comment. My question is, I know it can be hard to choose, but who is your personal favorite Maine humorist? And as you think about that, I'd just like to add my comment and wish Keith a happy humor-filled birthday. Happy birthday, Keith.
Oh, thanks for sneaking that in, Luke. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to the panel. A favorite Maine humorist. It is hard to pick, but Dennis, you can go first.
Well, it is hard to pick. There's so many good ones. I mean, I think Marshall Dodge has is the winner in a lot of categories. He was kind of my first real opening to see, you know, Maine humor as Maine humor is decided. And he was a good guy. He was a good, clever guy and just really funny. And my brother and I, when we get together, we'll do Marshall Dodge impressions and tell the stories. And he does it better than me, but he would be my first choice, I think.
Yeah. He took a little scrutiny for it because he wasn't from here. And he was essentially doing an imitation himself,
right.
But it was so popular nationally that he's sort of credited with bringing it to the fore in many ways.
Well,
I have to agree with Dennis. I'm a Marshall Dodge guy also. I knew him pretty well back in those days. He did a couple of functions for me when I was running for office. And of course, he's gone now. He was killed in an unfortunate accident in Hawaii, as I recall.
Yeah.
But I still tell Bert and I stories, but not with the style that he did.
Yeah.
I don't think I won't say I won't pick a favorite, but I will just say that Robert Skoglund lived just down the road from me here. And his brother, James Skoglund, was my sixth grade homeroom teacher. He went on to serve in the legislature. So we had sort of have a connection to the late humble farmer.
I think both of those, all of the people you mentioned are in that introductory chapter. We tried to take Maine humor back to the 19th century and pick and choose a whole variety of different people. I'm kind of most interested in the sayings that we use in our daily lives until they become cliches, like you can't get here from there. And my favorite, which I used just yesterday at my grandson's baseball game, you go up to somebody that you haven't seen in a while and you say, "Oh my God, are you out on bail?" And that's usually a showstopper. Another one, of course, in rural Maine is, "Have you got your deer yet?" And that's always struck me as kind of a crazy thing to say, as if you had petted and secured food and water for a particular deer and kept the coyotes away only so you could kill it and eat it in November. And as we point out in the book, the best place to get your deer, of course, is in Cape Elizabeth. There are 40 deer per square mile there compared to five up country. So it's the opening chapter, I think, is really interesting because everybody's favorite is in there. And, you know, we don't treat them all with kid gloves the way you guys are doing it now. I mean, you know, Bert and I, for God's sake, there's mayhem and death and, you know, destruction and lobster boats going down. And, you know, we read the chapter. It's not all fun and games.
Yeah. Were there stories you left out because they were just too much?
There was a couple. There was one about my college years that we decided was a bit too off color.
I think Dave was our real conscience. I think Dennis and I tended to go to the far side, and Dave would bring us back because he's got, you know, guys, you know, there are going to be some teenagers reading this stuff. But Dave was our, not only our conscience, but our guide to, you know, the Maine the way it should be.
Yeah.
One thing I did notice that in a couple of stories, it reminds us that the red and blue map that we know now today is the political map of Maine was different. Back then, for example, in David Emery and here in Rockland and Thomaston, it was pretty red for a long time, right? I mean, when did?
Oh no, that's absolutely right. The you couldn't find Democrats in the Mid Coast area. It was the rare thing. In fact, all the way from Eastport to Bath, they were pretty well outnumbered.
And so has that just been a demographic change, or we don't need to get into this, but I'm just curious about when that started to change.
Well, it really started with the Goldwater election, I think, when people finally realized that if they voted for a Democrat, they weren't automatically going to hell. But after a certain period of time, the Republican Party went further and further to the right. Most Maine people are fairly moderate centrists. Mm. So, and then with the increase in communication and travel and news being exchanged from all over the country, it opened up opportunities for Democrats to win in areas where they hadn't won before. And of course, the converse is true. Republican running in Brumford or Mexico or Waterville now is not nearly as outnumbered as he might have been 40 years ago. So, you know, it's been an evolution that's taken place over the last 40 or 50 years. Not at all uncommon in the United States.
The story the reference you just made about going to hell for voting, this is the sort of the punchline of a story by the late Bill Diamond, who wrote about going door to door in what was then a very red town of Falmouth. And he meets a nice lady who brings him in and is very nice to him until she finds out that he's a Democrat. can you finish? Do you remember the story? Do you know the?
Yeah, I do. And I've had that same experience. I mean, when I was running for Congress, I spent a lot of time in places like Biddeford and Sanford and Old Orchard Beach and you know, because I couldn't have won my first term in Congress without breaking into those heavily Franco-American Democratic communities. And time and time and time again, I would run into someone who was perfectly open and friendly and interested in what I had to say. And then the question was asked, and when they found out I wasn't a Democrat, the curtain closed.
Yeah, right. Well, so, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're unfortunately out of time. Thank you so much. Chris Potthome, Dennis Bailey, and Dave Emery, the editors of the just-released book, Real Life, Real Funny, The Way Maine Humor Should Be. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy, Maine Calling, produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Young People and Politics. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.